Now, listen to me, too. Lena has a fixed idea that all I think about is money, and maybe it's true. But I'm doing it for the family, for her brother, for her father, for all her relatives. Am I wrong? You're very educated. Tell me if I'm wrong. What does she want from me? The poverty she comes from? Should only the Saladas make money? Do we want to leave the neighborhood in their hands? If you tell me I'm wrong, I won't argue with you. I will immediately admit that I'm wrong. But with her, I have to argue whether I want to or not. She doesn't want me, she told me. She repeats it to me. Making her understand that I'm her husband is a battle. And ever since I got married, life has been unbearable. To see her in the morning, in the evening, to sleep next to her, and not be able to make her feel how much I love her, with the strength I'm capable of, is a terrible thing. I looked at his broad hands gripping the steering wheel, his face. With tears in his eyes, he admitted that on their wedding night, he had had to beat her, that he had been forced to do it, that every morning, every evening, she drew slaps from his hands on purpose to humiliate him, forcing him to act in a way that he never, ever, ever would have wanted. Here, he assumed an almost frightened tone. I had to beat her again. She shouldn't have gone to the Saladas dressed like that. But she has a force inside that I can't subdue. It's an evil force that makes good manners, everything, useless. A poison. You see, she's not pregnant. Months pass and nothing happens. Relatives, friends, customers ask. And you can see the mockery on their faces. Any news? And I have to say, what news? Pretending not to understand. Because if I understood, I would have to answer. But what can I answer? There are things you know that can't be said. With that force she has, she murders the children inside, Lenu. And she does it on purpose to make people think I don't know how to be a man, to show me up in front of everyone. What do you think? Am I exaggerating? You don't know what a favor you're doing to listen to me. I didn't know what to say. I was stunned. I had never heard a man talk about himself like that. The whole time, even when he spoke of his own brutality, he used a dialect full of feeling, defenseless, like the language of certain songs. I still don't know why he behaved that way. Of course, afterward, he revealed what he wanted. He wanted me to ally myself with him for the good of Leela. He said that she had to be helped to understand how necessary it was to behave like a wife and not like an enemy. He asked me to persuade her to help out in the second grocery and with the accounts. But for that purpose, he didn't have to confess to me in that way. Probably he thought that Leela had kept me minutely informed, and therefore he had to give me his version of the facts. Or maybe he hadn't counted on opening himself up so frankly to his wife's best friend, and had done so only on the wave of emotion. Or he hypothesized that, if he moved me, I would then move Leela by reporting everything to her. Certainly I listened to him with increasing sympathy. I was pleased by that free flow of intimate confidences. But above all, I have to admit what pleased me was the importance he attached to me. When in his own words he articulated a suspicion that I myself had always had, that is, that Leela harbored a force that made her capable of anything, even of keeping her body from conceiving children. It seemed that he was attributing to me a beneficent power, one that could win over Leela's maleficent one. And this flattered me. We got out of the car and arrived at the dressmaker's shop. I felt consoled by that acknowledgement. I went so far as to say pompously, in Italian, that I would do everything possible to help them to be happy. But as soon as we were in front of the dressmaker's window, I became nervous again. We both stopped to look at the framed photograph of Leela amid fabrics of many colors. She was seated, her legs crossed, her wedding dress pulled up a little to reveal her shoes, an ankle. She rested her chin on the palm of one hand. Her gaze was solemn, intense, turned boldly toward the lens, and in her hair shone a crown of orange blossoms. The photographer had been fortunate. I felt that he had caught the force Stefano had talked about. It was a force, I seemed to grasp, against which not even Leela could prevail. I turned as if to say to him, in admiration and at the same time dismay, "Here's what we were talking about." But he pushed open the door and let me go in first. The tones he had used with me disappeared, and he was harsh with the dressmaker. He said that he was Lena's husband. He used that precise construction. He explained that he too was in business, but that it would never occur to him to get publicity in that way. He went so far as to say, "You are a good-looking woman. What would your husband say if I took a photograph of you and stuck it in amid the provolone and salami?" He asked for the photograph back. The dressmaker was bewildered. She tried to defend herself, and finally she gave in. But she appeared very unhappy, and to demonstrate the effectiveness of her initiative and the basis of her regret, she told three or four anecdotes that later, over the years, became a small legend in the neighborhood. Among those who had stopped in to ask for information about the young woman in the wedding dress during the period in which the photograph was in the window were the famous singer Renato Carosone, an Egyptian prince, Vittorio De Sica, and a journalist from the paper Roma, who had wanted to talk to Leela and send a photographer to do a story on bathing suits like the ones worn at beauty contests. The dressmaker swore that she had refused to give Leela's address to anyone, even though, especially in the case of Carazzone and of De Sica, the refusal had seemed to her very rude, given the status of those persons. I noticed that the more the dressmaker talked, the more Stefano softened again. He became sociable. He wanted the woman to tell him in more detail about those episodes. When we left, taking with us the photograph, his mood had changed, and the monologue of the return did not have the anguished tone of the earlier one. Stefano was cheerful. He began to speak of Leela with the pride of someone possessing a rare object whose ownership confers great prestige. Of course, he asked again for my help, and before leaving me at my house, he made me swear over and over that I would try to make Leela understand what was the right path and what was wrong. Yet Leela, in his words, was no longer a person who couldn't be controlled, but a sort of precious fluid stored in a container that belonged to him. In the following days, Stefano told everyone, even in the grocery, about Carazzone and De Sica, so that the story spread, and Leela's mother, Nunzia, as long as she lived, went around repeating to everyone that her daughter would have had the opportunity of becoming a singer and actress, appearing in the film Marriage, Italian Style, going on television, even becoming an Egyptian princess, if the dressmaker of the Retifilo had not been so reticent, and if fate had not let her marry, at the age of 16, Stefano Caracci. 19. The chemistry teacher was generous with me. Or maybe it was Professor Galliani who went to the trouble to get her to be generous and gave me a pass. I was promoted with average grades in literary subjects, low passing grades in scientific ones, a narrow pass in religion, and, for the first time, a less than perfect grade in behavior, a sign that the priest and a great many of the teachers had never really forgiven me. I was sorry about it. I felt that my old dispute with the religion teacher on the role of the Holy Spirit had been presumptuous, and I regretted not having listened to Alfonso, who at the time had tried to restrain me. Naturally, I did not get a scholarship, and my mother was enraged, saying that it was all because of the time I had wasted with Antonio. Her words infuriated me. I said I didn't want to go to school anymore. She raised her hand to slap me, feared for my glasses, and hurried to get the carpet beater. Terrible days, in other words, and they got worse. The only thing that seemed positive was that the morning I went to see the grades, the janitor came up and handed me a package left by Professor Galliani. It was books, but not novels. Books full of arguments, a subtle sign of trust that still was not enough to bring me relief. I had too many worries, and whatever I did, the feeling of always being in the wrong. I looked for my old boyfriend at home and at his job, but he always managed to avoid me. I stuck my head in the grocery to ask Ada for help. She treated me coldly, said that her brother didn't want to see me anymore, and from then on, if we met, she looked the other way. Now that there was no school, waking up in the morning became traumatic, a kind of painful blow to the head. At first, I tried to read Professor Galliani's books, but I was bored. I could scarcely understand them. I started to borrow novels from the circulating library and read one after the other. But in the long run, they didn't help. They presented intense lives, profound conversations, a phantom reality more appealing than my real life. So, in order to feel as if I were not real, I sometimes went all the way to school in the hope of seeing Nino, who was taking the graduation exams. The day of the written Greek test, I waited for hours, patiently. But just as the first candidates began to emerge, with Rocci under their arms, the pretty, pure girl I had seen raising her lips to him appeared. She settled herself to wait not far from me, and in a second I was imagining the two of us, models displayed in a catalog, as we would appear to the eyes of Saratore's son the moment he came out of the door. I felt ugly, shabby, and I left. I went to Leela's house in search of comfort, but I knew I had made a mistake with her, too. I had done something stupid. I hadn't told her about going with Stefano to get the photograph. Why had I been silent? Was I pleased with the role of peacemaker that her husband had proposed? And did I think I could exercise it better by being silent about the visit to the Rettifilo? Had I been afraid of betraying Stefano's confidence and, as a result, without realizing it, betrayed her? I didn't know. Certainly it hadn't been a real decision, rather an uncertainty that first became a feigned carelessness, then the conviction that not having said right away what had happened made remedying the situation complicated and perhaps vain. How easy it was to do wrong. I sought excuses that might seem convincing to her, but I wasn't able to make them even to myself. I sensed that the foundations of my behavior were flawed. I was silent. On the other hand, she had never indicated that she knew the encounter had taken place. She always welcomed me kindly, let me take a bath in her bathtub, use her makeup. But she made few comments on the plots of the novels that I recounted to her, preferring to give me frivolous information about the lives of actors and singers she read about in the magazines. And she no longer told me any of her thoughts or secret plans. If I saw a bruise, if I took that as a starting point to get her to examine the reasons for Stefano's ugly reaction, if I said that maybe he had been cruel because he would like her to help him, support him in his difficulties, she looked at me ironically. She shrugged. She was evasive. In a short time, I understood that although she didn't want to break off her relationship with me, she had decided not to confide in me anymore. Did she in fact know and no longer considered me a trustworthy friend? I even went so far as to make my visits less frequent, hoping that she would feel my absence, ask the reason for it, and we would explain things to each other. But she didn't seem to notice. Then I couldn't stand it, and went back to visiting constantly, which seemed to make her neither happy nor unhappy. That very hot day in July, I was especially depressed when I arrived at her house. And yet I said nothing about Nino, about Nino's girlfriend, because without intending to, it's the way these things go. I had ended up reducing the play of confidences almost to nothing myself. She was welcoming as usual. She made an orzata. I curled up on the couch in the dining room to drink the cold almond syrup, irritated by the clatter of the trains, by the sweat, by everything. I observed her silently as she moved through the house. I was enraged by her capacity to travel through the most depressing labyrinths, holding on to the thread of her declaration of war without showing it. I thought of what her husband had told me, his words about the power that Leela held back, like the spring of a dangerous device. I looked at her stomach and imagined that truly inside it, every day, every night, she was fighting a battle to destroy the life that Stefano wanted to insert there by force. How long will she resist, I wondered. But I didn't dare to ask explicit questions. I knew she would consider them disagreeable. A little later, Pinuccia arrived, apparently to visit her sister-in-law. But in fact, 10 minutes afterward, Reno showed up, and he and Pina began kissing, practically right in front of us, in a way so excessive that Leela and I exchanged looks. When Pina said she wanted to see the view, he followed her, and they shut themselves in a room for a good half hour. This happened often. Leela talked about it with a mixture of irritation and sarcasm, and I was envious of the couple's ease. No fear, no misery. When they reappeared, they were more contented than before. Reno went to the kitchen to get something to eat. Returning, he talked about shoes with his sister. He said that things were constantly improving, and tried to get suggestions from her that he could later take credit for with the Solaras. "You know that Marcello and Michele want to put your picture in the store in Piazza dei Martiri?" he asked suddenly, in an appealing tone. "It doesn't seem appropriate," Pinuccia immediately interrupted. "Why not?" Reno asked. "What sort of question is that? If she wants, Lena can put the picture in the new grocery. She's going to run it, no? If I'm getting the shop in Piazza dei Martiri, will you let me decide what goes in it?" She spoke as if she were defending Leela's rights against her brother's intrusiveness. In fact, we all knew that she was defending herself and her own future. She was tired of depending on Stefano. She wanted to quit the grocery store, and she liked the idea of being the proprietor of a store in the center of the city. So a small war had been going on for some time between Reno and Michele, whose object was the management of the shoe store, a war inflamed by pressure from their respective fiancés. Reno insisted that Pinuccia should do it, Michele that Giliola should. But Pinuccia was the more aggressive, and had no doubt that she would get the best of it. She knew that she could add the authority of her brother to that of her fiancé. And so at every opportunity she put on airs, like someone who has already made the leap, has left behind the old neighborhood, and now decrees what is suitable and what is not for the sophisticated customers in the center. I realized that Reno was afraid his sister would take the offensive, but Leela displayed complete indifference. Then he checked his watch to let us all know that he was very busy, and said in the tone of one who sees into the future, "In my opinion, that photograph has great commercial possibilities." Then he kissed Pina, who immediately drew back to signal disapproval, and left. We girls remained. Pinuccia, hoping to use my authority to settle the question, asked me sulkily, "Lenu, what do you think? Do you think the photo of Lena should stay in Piazza dei Martiri?" I said in Italian, "It's Stefano who should decide, and since he went to the dressmaker purposely to get it removed from her window, I consider it out of the question that he'll give permission." Pinuccia glowed with satisfaction and almost shouted, "My goodness, how smart you are, Lenu!" I waited for Leela to have her say. There was a long silence. Then she spoke, just to me. "How much do you want to bet you're wrong? Stefano will give his permission."
"No."
"Yes." "What do you want to bet?" "If you lose, you must never again pass with anything less than the best grades." I looked at her in embarrassment. We hadn't spoken about my difficulties. I didn't even think she knew. But she was well informed and was now reproaching me. "You weren't up to it," she was saying. "Your grades fell." She expected from me what she would have done in my place. She really wanted me fixed in the role of someone who spends her life with books, while she had money, nice clothes, a house, television, a car, took everything, granted everything. "And if you lose?" I asked, with a shade of bitterness. That look of hers returned instantly, shot through dark slits. "I'll enroll in a private school, start studying again, and I swear I'll get my diploma along with you and do better than you." "Along with you and do better than you." Was that what she had in mind? I felt as if everything that was roiling inside me in that terrible time, Antonio, Nino, the unhappiness with the nothing that was my life, had been sucked up by a broad sigh. "Are you serious? When is a bet ever made as a joke?" Pinuccia interrupted aggressively, "Lena, don't start acting crazy the way you always do. You have the new grocery store. Stefano can't manage it alone." Immediately, however, she controlled herself, adding with false sweetness, "Besides, I'd like to know when you and Stefano are going to make me an aunt." She used that sweet-sounding formula, but her tone seemed resentful to me, and I felt the reasons for that resentment irritatingly mixed with mine. Pinuccia meant, "You're married. My brother gives you everything. Now do what you're supposed to do." And in fact, what's the sense of being Signora Caracci if you're going to shut all the doors, barricade yourself, obstruct, guard a poisoned fury in your stomach? Is it possible that you must always do harm, Leela? When will you stop? Will your energy diminish? Will you be distracted? Will you finally collapse like a sleepy sentinel? When will you grow wide and sit at the cash register in the new neighborhood with your stomach swelling and make Pinucha an aunt and me, leave me to go my own way? Who knows? Leela answered, and her eyes grew large and deep again. Am I going to become a mama first? Said her sister-in-law, smiling. If you're always pasted Dorino like that, it's possible. They had a little skirmish. I didn't stay to listen. 20. To placate my mother, I had to find a summer job. Naturally, I went to the stationer. She welcomed me the way you'd welcome a school teacher or the doctor. She called her daughters, who were playing in the back of the shop, and they embraced me, kissed me, wanted me to play with them. When I mentioned that I was looking for a job, she said that she was ready to send her daughters to the sea garden right away, without waiting for August, just so that they could spend their days with a good, intelligent girl like me. Right away when? I asked. Next week? Wonderful. I'll give you a little more money than last year. That finally seemed to be good news. I went home satisfied, and my mood didn't change, even when my mother said that as usual I was lucky. Going swimming and sitting in the sun wasn't a job. Encouraged, the next day I went to see Maestra Oliviero. I was upset about having to tell her that I hadn't particularly distinguished myself in school that year. But I needed to see her. I had to tactfully remind her to get me the books for the next school year. And then I thought it would please her to know that Leela, now that she had made a good marriage and had so much free time, might start studying again. Reading in her eyes the reaction to that would help soothe the unease it had provoked in me. I knocked and knocked. The teacher didn't come to the door. I asked the neighbors and around the neighborhood and returned an hour later, but still she didn't answer. And yet no one had seen her go out, nor had I met her on the streets or in the shops. Since she was a woman alone, old and not well, I went back to the neighbors. The woman who lived next door decided to ask her son for help. The young man got into the apartment by climbing from the balcony of his mother's apartment into one of the teacher's windows. He found her on the kitchen floor, in her nightgown. She had fainted. The doctor was called, and he thought that she should be admitted to the hospital immediately. They carried her downstairs. I saw her as she emerged from the entrance, in disarray, her face swollen. She, who always came to school carefully groomed. Her eyes were frightened. I gave her a nod of greeting, and she lowered her gaze. They settled her in a car that took off blasting its horn. The heat that year must have had a cruel effect on frailer bodies. In the afternoon, Melina's children could be heard in the courtyard, calling their mother in increasingly worried voices. When the cries didn't stop, I went to see what was happening and ran into Ada. She said anxiously, her eyes shiny with tears, that Melina couldn't be found. Right afterward, Antonio arrived, out of breath and pale. He didn't even look at me, but hurried off. Soon half the neighborhood was looking for Melina, even Stefano, who, still in his grocer's smock, got in the convertible, with Ada beside him, and drove slowly along the streets. I followed Antonio, and we ran here and there, without saying a word. We ended up near the ponds and made our way through the tall grass, calling his mother. His cheeks were hollow. He had dark circles under his eyes. I took his hand, wanting to be of comfort. But he repulsed me. With an odious phrase, he said, "Leave me alone. You're no woman." I felt a sharp pain in my chest. But just then, we saw Melina. She was sitting in the water, cooling off. Her face and neck were sticking out from the greenish surface. Her hair was soaked, her eyes red, her lips matted with leaves and mud. She was silent. She, whose attacks of madness had for 10 years taken the form of shouting or singing. We brought her home, Antonio supporting her on one side, I on the other. People seemed relieved, called to her. She waved weakly. I saw Leela next to the gate, isolated in her house in the new neighborhood. She must have heard the news late and hadn't taken part in the search. I knew that she felt a strong bond with Melina, but it struck me that, while everyone was showing signs of sympathy, and here was Ada running toward her crying, "Mama," followed by Stefano, who had left the car in the middle of the stradone with the doors open, and had the happy expression of someone who has had ugly thoughts but now discovers that all is well. She stood apart, with an expression that was hard to describe. She seemed to be moved by the pitiful sight of the widow, dirty, smiling faintly, her light clothes soaked and muddy, the outline of her wasted body visible under the material, the feeble wave of greeting to friends and acquaintances. But Leela also seemed to be wounded by it, and frightened, as if she felt inside the same disruption. I nodded to her, but she didn't respond. I gave up Melina to her daughter then, and tried to join Leela. I also wanted to tell her about Maestra Oliviero, about the terrible thing Antonio had said to me. But I couldn't find her. She was gone. 21. When I saw Leela again, I realized immediately that she felt bad, and tended to make me feel bad too. We spent a morning at her house in an atmosphere that seemed to be playful. In fact, she insisted, with growing spitefulness, that I try on all her clothes, even though they didn't fit me. The game became torture. She was taller and thinner. Everything of hers that I put on made me look ridiculous. But she wouldn't admit it. She said, "All you need is an adjustment here or there." And yet her mood darkened as she gazed at me, as if my appearance offended her. At a certain point, she exclaimed, "That's enough." She looked as if she had seen a ghost. Then she pulled herself together and, assuming a frivolous tone, told me that a couple of nights earlier, she had gone to have ice cream with Pasquale and Ada. I was in my slip, helping her put the clothes back on the hangers. With Pasquale and Ada? Yes. And Stefano, too? Just me. Did they invite you? No, I asked them. And as though she wanted to surprise me, she added that she hadn't confined herself to that brief visit to the old world of her girlhood. The next day, she had gone to have pizza with Enzo and Carmela. Also by yourself? Yes. And what does Stefano say? She made a grimace of indifference. Being married doesn't mean leading the life of an old lady. If he wants to come with me, fine. If he's too tired in the evening, I go out by myself. How was it? I had fun. I hoped she couldn't read the disappointment in my face. We saw each other frequently. She could have said, "Tonight I'm going out with Ada, Pasquale, Enzo, Carmela. Do you want to come?" Instead, she had said nothing. She had arranged and managed those outings by herself, in secret, as if they had been not our friends forever, but only hers. And now she was telling me in detail, with an air of satisfaction, everything they had said. Ada was worried. Melina ate almost nothing and threw up whatever she did eat. Pasquale was anxious about his mother, Giuseppina, who couldn't sleep, felt a heaviness in her legs, had palpitations, and when she returned from visiting her husband in prison, wept inconsolably. I listened. I noticed that, more than usual, she had an involved way of talking. She chose emotionally charged words. She described Melina Capuccio and Giuseppina Peluso as if their bodies had seized hers, imposing on it the same contracted or inflated forms, the same bad feelings. As she spoke, she touched her face, her breast, her stomach, her hips, as if they were no longer hers, and showed that she knew everything about those women, down to the tiniest details, in order to prove that no one told me anything, but told her everything. Or, worse, in order to make me feel that I was wrapped in a fog, unable to see the suffering of the people around me. She spoke of Giuseppina as if she had kept up with her, despite the vortex of her engagement and marriage. She spoke of Melina as if the mother of Ada and Antonio had always been in her mind, and she were thoroughly familiar with her madness. Then she went on to enumerate many other people in the neighborhood, people whom I hardly knew, but whose histories she seemed to know, as if she had a sort of long-distance involvement in their lives. Finally, she announced, "I also had ice cream with Antonio." That name was a punch in the stomach. "How is he?" "Fine." "Did he say anything about me?" "No, nothing." "When does he leave?" "In September." Marcello did nothing to help him. It was predictable. Predictable? If it was predictable, I thought, that the Solaras would do nothing, why did you take me there? And why do you, who are married, now want to see your friends again, like that, by yourself? And why did you have ice cream with Antonio without telling me, knowing that he is my old boyfriend, and that though he doesn't want to see me anymore, I would like to see him? Do you want revenge, because I went driving with your husband and didn't report to you a word of what we said to each other?" I dressed nervously, mumbled that I had things to do, had to go. "I have something else to tell you." In a serious voice, she said that Rino, Marcello, and Michele had wanted Stefano to go to Piazza dei Martiri to see how well the shop was coming along, and that the three of them, amid sacks of cement and cans of paint and brushes, had pointed out the wall opposite the entrance and told him they were thinking of putting the enlargement of the photograph of her in her wedding dress there. Stefano had listened. Then he had answered that certainly it would be a good advertisement for the shoes, but that it didn't seem to him suitable. The three had insisted. He had said no to Marcello, no to Michele, and no to Rino as well. In other words, I had won the bet. Her husband had not given in to the Solaras. I said, making an effort to appear enthusiastic, "See? Always saying mean things about poor Stefano. And instead, I was right. Now you have to start studying." "Wait." "Wait for what? A bet is a bet, and you lost." "Wait," Leela repeated. My bad mood got worse. She doesn't know what she wants, I thought. She's unhappy that she was wrong about her husband. Or, I don't know, maybe I'm exaggerating. Maybe she appreciated Stefano's refusal. But she expects a more ferocious clash of men around her image. And she's disappointed because the Solaras weren't insistent enough. I saw that she was lazily running a hand over her hip and along one leg, like a caress of farewell. And in her eyes appeared for a moment that mixture of suffering, fear, and disgust that I had noticed the night of Melina's disappearance. I thought, and if, instead, she secretly wants her picture to be on display, enlarged in the center of the city, and is sorry that Michele didn't succeed in forcing it on Stefano? Why not? She wants to be the first in everything. She's made like that. The most beautiful, the most elegant, the wealthiest. Then I said to myself, above all, the most intelligent. And at the idea that Lila would really start studying again, I felt a regret that discouraged me. Of course she would make up for all the years of school she had missed. Of course I would find her beside me, elbow to elbow, taking the high school graduation exam. And I realized that the prospect was intolerable. But it was even more intolerable to discover that feeling in myself. I was ashamed, and immediately started telling her how wonderful it would be if we studied together again, and insisting that she should find out how to proceed. She shrugged, so I said, "Now I really have to go." This time she didn't stop me. 22. As usual, once I was on the stairs, I began to sympathize with her reasons, or so it seemed to me. She was isolated in the new neighborhood, shut up in her modern house, beaten by Stefano, engaged in some mysterious struggle with her own body in order not to conceive children. Envious of my success in school, to the point of indicating to me with that crazy bet that she would like to study again. Besides, it was likely that she saw me as much freer than she was. The breakup with Antonio, my troubles with school, seemed like nonsense compared to hers. Step by step, without realizing it, I felt driven to a grudging support, then renewed admiration. Yes, it would be wonderful if she started studying again. To return to the time of elementary school, when she was always first and I second. To give meaning back to studying, because she knew how to give it meaning. To stay in her shadow, and therefore feel strong and secure. Yes, 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 start again. At some point on the way home, the mixture of suffering, fear, and disgust I had seen in her face returned to my mind. Why? I thought back to the teacher's body in disarray, to Melina's uncontrolled body. For no obvious reason, I began to look closely at the women on the stradone. Suddenly, it seemed to me that I had lived with a sort of limited gaze, as if my focus had been only on us girls, Ada, Giliola, Carmela, Marisa, Pinuccia, Lila, me, my schoolmates. And I had never really paid attention to Melina's body, Giuseppina Peluso's, Nunzia Cerullo's, Maria Caracci's. The only woman's body I had studied with ever-increasing apprehension was the lame body of my mother. And I had felt pressed, threatened by that image, and still feared that it would suddenly impose itself on mine. That day, instead, I saw clearly the mothers of the old neighborhood. They were nervous. They were acquiescent. They were silent, with tight lips and stooping shoulders, or they yelled terrible insults at the children who harassed them. Extremely thin, with hollow eyes and cheeks, or with broad behinds, swollen ankles, heavy chests. They lugged shopping bags and small children, who clung to their skirts and wanted to be picked up. And good God, they were 10, at most 20 years older than me. Yet they appeared to have lost those feminine qualities that were so important to us girls, and that we accentuated with clothes, with makeup. They had been consumed by the bodies of husbands, fathers, brothers, whom they ultimately came to resemble, because of their labors or the arrival of old age, of illness. When did that transformation begin? With housework? With pregnancies? With beatings? Would Leela be misshapen like Nunzia? Would Fernando leap from her delicate face? Would her elegant walk become Reno's, legs wide, arms pushed out by his chest? And would my body, too, one day be ruined by the emergence of not only my mother's body, but my father's? And would all that I was learning at school dissolve? Would the neighborhood prevail again? The cadences, the manners, everything be confounded in a black mire? Anaximander and my father, Fulgore and Don Achille, Valences and the pond, Aorists, Hesiod, and the insolent vulgar language of the Salatas, as, over the millenniums, had happened to the chaotic, debased city itself? I was suddenly sure that, without being aware of it, I had intercepted Leela's feelings and was adding them to mine. Why did she have that expression, that ill humor? Had she caressed her leg, her hip, as a sort of farewell? Had she touched herself, speaking, as if she felt the edges of her body besieged by Melina, by Giuseppina, and was frightened, disgusted by it? Had she turned to our friends out of a need to react? I remembered how, as a child, she had looked at Maestra Oliviero when she fell off the platform like a broken puppet. I remembered how she had looked at Melina on the stradone, eating the soft soap she had just bought. I remembered when she told the rest of us about the murder and the blood on the copper pot, and claimed that the killer of Don Achille was not a man, but a woman. As if, in the story she was telling us, she had heard and seen the form of a female body break from the need for hatred, the urgency for revenge or justice, and lose its substance. 23. Starting in the last week of July, I went with the stationer's daughters to the Sea Garden every day, including Sunday. Along with the thousand things that the children might need, I brought in a canvas bag, the books that Professor Galliani had lent me. They were small volumes that examined the past, the present, the world as it was, and as it ought to become. The writing resembled that of textbooks, but was more difficult and more interesting. I wasn't used to that sort of reading, and got tired quickly. Besides, the girls required a lot of attention. And then there was the lazy sea, the leaden sun that bore down on the gulf and the city. Stray fantasies, desires, the ever-present wish to undo the order of the lines, and with it, every order that required an effort, a wait for fulfillment yet to come, and yield instead to what was within reach, immediately gained, the crude life of the creatures of the sky, the earth, and the sea. I approached my 17th birthday with one eye on the daughters of the stationer, and one on Discourse on the Origins of Inequality. One Sunday, I felt someone putting fingers over my eyes, and a female voice asked, "Guess who?" I recognized Marisa's voice, and hoped that she was with Nino. How I would have liked him to see me made beautiful by the sun, the salt water, and intent on reading a difficult book. I exclaimed happily, "Marisa," and immediately turned around. But Nino wasn't there. It was Alfonso, with a blue towel over his shoulder, cigarette, wallet, and lighter in his hand, a black bathing suit with a white stripe, he himself pale as one who has never had a ray of sun in his entire life. I marveled at seeing them together. Alfonso had to retake exams in two subjects in October, and since he was busy in the grocery, I imagined that on Sundays he studied. As for Marisa, I was sure that she would be at Barano with her family. Instead, she told me that her parents had quarreled with Nella the year before, and, with some friends from Roma, had taken a small villa at Castel Volturno. She had returned to Naples just for a few days. She needed some school books, three subjects to do again. And then she had to see a person. She smiled flirtatiously at Alfonso. The person was him. I couldn't contain myself. I asked right away how Nino had done on his graduation exams. She made a face of disgust. All A's and A minuses. As soon as he found out the results, he went off on his own to England, without a lira. He says he'll find a job there and stay until he learns English. Then, I don't know. Maybe he'll enroll in economy and business. I had 1,000 other questions. I even looked for a way to ask who the girl was who waited outside school, and if he had really gone alone, or in fact with her, when Alfonso said, embarrassed, "Lena's here too." Then he added, "Antonio brought us in the car." Antonio? Alfonso must have noticed how my expression changed, the flush that was spreading over my face, the jealous amazement in my eyes. He smiled and said quickly, "Stefano had some work to do about the counters in the new grocery and couldn't come, but Lena was extremely eager to see you. She has something to tell you, and so she asked Antonio if he would take us." "Yes, she has something urgent to tell you," Marisa said emphatically, clapping her hands gleefully to let me know that she already knew the thing. What thing? Judging from Marisa, it seemed good. Maybe Lila had soothed Antonio, and he wanted to be with me again. Maybe the Salaras had finally roused their acquaintances at the recruiting office, and Antonio didn't have to go. These hypotheses came to mind immediately, but when the two appeared, I eliminated both right away. Clearly, Antonio was there only because obeying Lila gave meaning to his empty Sunday. Only because to be her friend seemed to him a piece of luck and a necessity. But his expression was still unhappy, his eyes frightened, and he greeted me coldly. I asked about his mother, but he gave me scarcely any news. He looked around uneasily and immediately dived into the water with the girls, who welcomed him warmly. As for Lila, she was pale, without lipstick, her gaze hostile. She didn't seem to have anything urgent to tell me. She sat on the concrete, picked up the book I was reading, leafed through it without a word. Marisa, in the face of those silences, became ill at ease. She tried to make a show of enthusiasm for everything in the world. Then she got flustered, and she too went to swim. Alfonso chose a place as far from us as possible, and, sitting motionless in the sun, concentrated on the bathers, as if the sight of naked people going in and out of the water were utterly absorbing. "Who gave you this book?" Lila asked. "My professor of Latin and Greek." "Why didn't you tell me?" "I didn't think it would interest you." "Do you know what is of interest to me and what isn't?" I immediately resorted to a conciliatory tone, but I also felt a need to brag. As soon as I finish, I'll lend it to you. These are books that the professor gives the good students to read. Nino reads them too.
Who is Nino?
Did she do it on purpose? Did she pretend not even to remember his name in order to diminish him in my eyes? The one in the wedding film, Marisa's brother, Salvatore's oldest son. The ugly guy you like? I told you that I don't like him anymore, but he does great things.
What?
Now, for instance, he's in England. He's working, traveling, learning to speak English. I was excited merely by summarizing Marisa's words. I said to Leela, imagine if you and I could do things like that. Travel, work as waiters to support ourselves, learn to speak English better than the English. Why can he be free to do that and we can't? Did he finish school? Yes, he got his diploma. Afterward, though, he's going to do a difficult course at the university.
Is he smart?
As smart as you.
I don't go to school.
Yes, but you lost the bet, and now you have to go back to books.
Stop it, Lenu.
Stefano won't let you.
There's the new grocery. I'm supposed to manage it.
You'll study in the grocery.
No.
You promised. You said we'd get our diploma together.
No.
Why? Leela ran her hand back and forth over the cover of the book, ironing it.
I'm pregnant, she said.
And without waiting for me to react, she muttered, it's so hot. Left the book, went to the edge of the concrete, hurled herself without hesitation into the water, yelling at Antonio, who was playing and splashing with Marisa and the children.
Tony, save me!
She flew for a few seconds, arms wide, then clumsily hit the surface of the water. She didn't know how to swim.
24. In the days that followed, Leela started on a period of feverish activity. She began with the new grocery, involving herself as if it were the most important thing in the world. She woke up early, before Stefano. She threw up, made coffee, threw up again. He had become very solicitous. He wanted to drive her, but Leela refused. She said she wanted to walk. And she went out in the cool air of the morning, before the heat exploded, along the deserted streets, past the newly constructed buildings, most of them still empty, to the store that was being fitted out. She pulled up the shutter, washed the paint-splattered floor, waited for the workers and suppliers who were delivering scales, slicers, and furnishings, gave orders on where to place them, moved things around herself, trying out new, more efficient arrangements. Large, threatening men, rough-mannered boys, were ordered about and submitted to her whims without protesting. Since she had barely finished giving an order when she undertook some other heavy job, they cried in apprehension, "Signora Caracci," and did all they could to help her. Leela, in spite of the heat, which sapped her energy, did not confine herself to the shop in the new neighborhood. Sometimes she went with her sister-in-law to the small worksite in Piazza dei Martiri, where Michele generally presided, but often Reno, too, was there, feeling he had the right to monitor the work, both as the maker of Cerullo shoes and as the brother-in-law of Stefano, who was the Solara's partner. Leela would not stay still in that space, either. She inspected it. She climbed the workmen's ladders. She observed the place from high up. She came down. She began to move things. At first, she hurt everybody's feelings, but soon, one after the other, they reluctantly gave in. Michele, although the most sarcastically hostile, seemed to grasp most readily the advantages of Lena's suggestions.
Signor, he said, teasing, come and rearrange the bar, too. I'll pay you.